Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Always, always, always a privilege. I count it a privilege and an honor that you choose to spend a little time with me. So thank you for the time that we have together today. All right. So I'm going to just jump in here headfirst into actually a series of headlines related to Turkey. So we have been following the Andrew Brunson story since Andrew Brunson was basically taken captive by the Turks in October of 2016, following the failed coup attempt there earlier that year in July. And we have talked about Andrew Brunson at length. We have called for prayers. We have posted numbers of opportunities for you to engage on this subject matter. And just last week, we were celebrating that he had been moved from the prison to house arrest. And so that is a wonderful development. However, we are now learning that what should have happened, what was expected to happen, what had actually been mutually agreed upon through back channel communications between those advocating for his release here in the United States government and the Trump administration and those in Turkey, was actually that Andrew was going to be released from prison and then deported. He should be home in North Carolina by now, not sitting in under ongoing house arrest as a hostage in Turkey. So let me back up and cover a couple of things from this story so that you can be the most well-informed person in the room when this subject matter rises in conversation. For those of you who are paying attention, the United States has issued really, actually unprecedented sanctions against two high-level officials in Turkey for what the Trump administration says is their role in the case of U.S. Pastor Andrew Brunson, who faces, you will remember, terrorism-related charges that have no basis in reality. So at the president's direction, the Department of the Treasury is sanctioning two of Turkey's highest-ranking ministers, both of whom our government says played leading roles in the arrest, detention, and ongoing accusations against Andrew Brunson. So the Treasury Department here in the United States is on the forefront of this, and this move actually follows reports on Tuesday that a Turkish court denied Brunson's latest appeal on charges of espionage and committing crimes on behalf of terror groups without being a member of one. So we need to have ongoing prayers for Andrew, and we also need to remember that Andrew Brunson is not the only American who is being held in Turkey under these kinds of charges. And we're reminded reminded of that if we actually pay attention to the content of not only these sanctions, but other efforts by United States senators and others to win the release of other Americans in addition to Andrew Brunson, who are being illegally detained by our supposedly NATO ally, Turkey. So let me tell you how the sanctions thing works, because you're thinking to yourself, I don't even really know what a sanction is. I don't know how this works. I don't know what impact it has. Well, just the very threat, the very idea, the very suspicion that the United States was working on a sanctions package. These are actually called designation packages. So they identify particular individuals who are going to be targeted, and they're going to impose these penalties on those individuals. And if the individuals are of a high enough rank in a particular government, it's like pulling a it's like touching off a domino that, you know, you have set up in alignment with other dominoes. Or if you made a house of cards and you pulled out the bottom one, or if you pulled the wrong brick out, or actually the right brick out of Jenga, and the whole thing came crashing down. That's what these designation packages are actually designed to do when we talk about international sanctions. So these international sanctions were prepared under what's called the Global Magnitsky, that has a G in the middle, Magnitsky Act of 2016, which allows the United States government to target individuals, companies, or other entities that are involved in corruption or human rights abuses anywhere in the world. And sanctions under these acts or under this act can allow for the seizure of particular assets that are already in the United States, travel bans, and Here's the real key. This is the bell ringer here. Prohibitions on doing business with any U.S. entity. When Bloomberg reported, that the United States was thinking about these kind of sanctions in relationship to the ongoing hostilities towards American citizens, including Pastor Andrew Brunson, the Turkish lira plunged to a record low of, 4.9985. So what we're talking here is a precipitous decline of the nation's currency in Turkey. So you and I might wonder, well, what kind of sanctions could ever be applied to an individual in the United States that would bring down our economy in this way? Well, there aren't any, because we are not in the kind of situation that Turkey is in. Turkey actually requires $200 million a day in foreign financing just to keep their government running. Think about that for a moment. The nation of Turkey requires $200 million a day in foreign financing. And so these sanctions actually pull the card out or the Jenga block or tip over the domino. And so you say to yourself, I don't know if this helps or this hurts in terms of getting Andrew Brunson home, but it certainly is making a point internationally that the Trump administration is dog tired of hostage negotiation. And if you want to read up more on that, we actually have a page aggregated at reconnectwithcarmen.com on the subject of Andrew Brunson and related materials and where you can go to be actively engaged in praying for him and working alongside other Americans to win his release. Let's also remember that Andrew is not the only American being unjustly held in Turkey. And so we want to continue advocating for the NASA scientist and the college professor who are also held captive as well. Liberty and justice for all means all of us, not just those who share our Christian faith. All right, friends, next up, I'm going to have a conversation with Craig Detweiler about a book entitled iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. When you think about Facebook, when you think about Apple, we just heard that they've reached the $1 trillion mark in market capitalization. When you think about these companies, what do you think and how do you think in terms of spirituality and social life? I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am thrilled to be joined today by Craig Detweiler. He's the author of iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. He's also an award-winning filmmaker, a cultural commentator, and he is the president of the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. You can follow him on Twitter at Craig Detweiler. Craig, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much, Carmen.
Okay, so this... this book, and folks, you can also like go to Vimeo and you can actually watch Craig talk for nearly an hour on this subject. because this book is so rich, and actually it's almost seems unfair to talk about it without visuals because we're in such an image rich time, and so much of what you talk about almost requires us being able to see what you're talking about. And so I'm going to let you draw a bunch of pictures as we talk today, okay?
Lovely. Sure.
Okay,
I'll do my best. I'll paint some visual imagery. Yes.
So we're going to lead off with this. What's the connection between the wheel, a pair of glasses, and the smartphone?
Well, yes, those things are actually, we take them as everyday aspects of our life, but they're all technologies. They're all inventions, and they're things that people use their God-given gifts to create and make our lives better. So God's given us that ability to be tool makers, and when we sometimes, I think we may have lost track with the smartphone that it's designed to serve us rather than us serving it. So that's part of what the book iGods is about, is reclaiming our power over these devices and our God-given ability to, understand and respond to our world.
So one of the things that I deeply appreciated was how you helped me understand that technology is It's not some force out there that's potentially against me. And it's not some force of evil, right? It's simply the tools that are available at any given point in time and how we use those tools or how we become servants of those tools on the flip side. Is really the conversation that I think you're trying to provoke.
That's right. Well, I think all of us, with our young people, right? We handed them a phone without maybe giving them a user's manual or an owner's guide, and we assumed that they would figure out, not just how to use it, but how to use it responsibly. And what we're discovering after the fact is that we've all kind of jumped in the pool, and then realized, like, wait, I need some guidelines. I need some handles on how to navigate this online world that is constant. It can feel overwhelming. The book iGods is a chance for us to kind of take that agency back in our life that says, no, God's given me a brain. He's actually given the phone an off switch. He's called us to enter into Sabbath, and we can actually do that with our phones. We can actually take a break. We can put it down. We can actually say, you know what, there's not going to be any phones during this phone call, during this dinner with our family. You know, we're not going to have any interruptions, at least electronic interruptions. We're going to be fully present with each other and available to God in a very present way as well.
Oh, sorry, Craig. I was checking my phone. Right? That
it's easy to do.
No, I of course was not checking my phone.
I think that
I want you, because you do use humor so effectively, I would love for you to equip the parent who's listening right now who has never they've never said we're not going to have phones at this meal. Spend a minute equipping them to have that conversation, because I do think that being actually present with other people is something that's lost, and it's a real serious loss.
Well, it is kind of it's actually the rarest thing that we often offer to each other, which is our undivided attention. And I think our children know that, our coworkers know that. I think our pastor senses that even as they're speaking. They're sort of like, are you with me? Are you listening? I'm not sure. And so I think before we have that conversation with our kids about whether they're using their phones too much or whether they're addicted or can they put them down, we also need to have that conversation with ourselves and realize that a lot of kids have retreated to their phones and to online worlds and to social media because we're distracted as parents. If you go to a park, you're going to see, and I'm there, I can be just as guilty. It's like I'm supposed to be there kind of playing with my kid and monitoring my kid and interacting with my own children, and yet I'm kind of drawn to keeping up, and maybe I need to respond real quick, and it'll just be a minute, and I'm just going to text this, and while you're texting, you're checking something else. So to have that conversation of kind of making sacred spaces or protected spaces within our home life, within our family life, we have to be willing to power down as individuals before we then invite our kids as well into that space and say, we're actually going to have an electronic-free meal right now, and to even have fun with it. You can create a basket in the middle and says, I'm going to start. I'm putting my phone in the basket as well, and so everybody now, let's all put it in the same basket and let's lock it up. Let's put the basket over on the shelf, and none of us can reach it, and none of us can see it, and therefore none of us will be tempted. God's given us that ability, it says, to resist or to remove temptation in our life. So if the temptation is to tweet or text, to just glance at our phone, then let's remove those phones, even for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes as a family, and enjoy that face-to-face presence being fully available to each other.
So I have a friend who I'll share this with you, and if you find it worthy, you can share it with others. They actually They have kids that, you know, sort of range in ages pretty broadly. They wanted to figure out how are we going to get rid of the phones, at least at mealtime, at least at the family mealtime.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did something similar to what you're suggesting, but they actually started doing it as a part of the meal. So they sit down and everything's on the table, you know, to be served family style. Like you're going to pass the potatoes, you're going to pass the meat, but the first thing that they pass is the empty, in your case, basket, but in her case, bowl. They have a wooden bowl.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first
mm-hmm.
thing that they pass around the table. And then it's set off to the side, and then they pass the food. So like you're suggesting, you can make it a part of the rhythm of what's happening, and that everybody's doing it, and we're doing it together, and it's a part of having in their family a family meal. So not every meal is family style at their house. Some of it's grab and go, like the rest of us,
mm-hmm.
or some of it's on the run.
Yep.
But when they have a family style meal, family style for them now includes no electronics.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. And what a simple and powerful solution. Pass the plate and pass
yeah.
your phone.
Exactly. Okay, hey, friends, I'm talking to Craig Detweiler. We're talking about his book, iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. Craig is also the president of the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, and an award-winning filmmaker and really an entertaining public speaker. So if you ever have the opportunity to be with him somewhere where he is speaking, he's a really fun platform speaker as well. So, Craig, I'm wondering... maybe you've given this some thought. How is it that technology became an idol and even a kind of religion to which, you know, we're devoted, for which we will make sacrifices, and in some cases, I mean, which we'll slavishly serve?
Yeah, that's a great question. Great question, Carmen. I think these things happen slowly and they happen subtly. And I think to some degree that my book, I unpack a little bit of the history of these companies. I look at Apple and Facebook and Google and Amazon and really think about where they started. And I think these companies maybe didn't, intend to get into world domination necessarily. They were doing some practical problem solving. But once they got into that and once they got into competing with each other, then they were now competing for our divided attention. And so their demands, in a sense, got even bigger and bigger. I think there's also maybe some false promises in terms of like, well, gosh, you know, your kid's got to have an iPad or else they're going to be left behind. You know, if they don't have the latest Apple computer, then the latest iPhone, then they're going to feel left out. Well, it's interesting in my research to discover that Steve Jobs actually didn't allow his own kids to play with iPads. He didn't have iPads in his own house. So as a company, right, they're saying you must keep up. You will do your children a disservice, right, if they do not have the latest and the greatest. And yet in his own life, the founders of Google were people who went to Montessori school. They were used to playing with physical objects and shapes and colors and manipulating their physical world. So there's a little bit of disingenuousness, I think, in that these iGods, right, not just the companies, but the founders of these companies have told us you must have this, and yet in their own families and their own lives, they don't incorporate their own products. So maybe we should think twice before we get into that kind of efficiency mindset that says I need to have the latest, the greatest, the fastest, and if not, I'm going to be left behind. Maybe we need to recover, in a sense, a slow faith, right, that understands that virtues of patience and love take time, and they aren't about fast, and they aren't about efficiency. Love isn't necessarily efficient. But it endures in a much more powerful way.
Hmm. Well, and I think that today, you know, we've now been in this iGen long enough that we have begun to see the very real effects of isolation and addiction and bullying and on and on and on. I mean, detrimental, seriously. I mean, even like kids whose now necks are malformed because, you know, starting at such an early age, their neck was always tuned in the direction of the electronic device. I am wondering, Craig, in terms of like the distraction of all the technology, do you think it's wounding not only our relationships with each other, but do you think it's wounding the depth of relationship that people are able to cultivate with God?
Well, these are really core questions, and I mean, I wrote the book as a way of pushing the pause button in my own life to say, like, I've kind of uncritically embraced this without stopping to think, like, well, wait, where's God in this? What is this doing to me? It is interesting. I think we've trained ourselves and really a whole new generation to look down rather than to look up. And looking up involves both the people to our right or left. You know, if you've been on any kind of public transportation, you'll see everybody is now, you know, looking down at the thing in their hands. There's not interaction on a bus, on a train, in a public space, even in a waiting room. Everybody's kind of absorbed in their world. And then there's also the looking up to God. And whether we have trained ourselves to look to Google for the answers rather than to God. You know, even Siri, you know, even these online assistants, they kind of offer this sense of omniscience. They're always on. They're always available. They'll always answer when you call them. And to some degree, that is stepping in a little bit into God's place and to space. And so are we doing less prayer and more time on social media? I don't know that we have statistics on that. We do have statistics about things like Facebook envy, that the more time you spend on time looking at other people's vacation photos and saying, gosh, look at their perfect life that they might be projecting in a way via Facebook, that we can get depressed. And there is, I think, a lot of depression on campus for kids. There's a concept called FOMO, fear of missing out. And so for a lot of young people, they see their friends online having a good time, and they think, why am I not there? Why am I not included, and what am I missing out on? So even to love one another in a digital space, I think we have to think before we post. You know, we might want to share something great in our life, but could that thing in our life actually depress someone else whose life might be struggling? And so how do we reach out to others online? What is digital discipleship look like? I think we're just now beginning to think about the real world implications in terms of relationships of our online life. And so we're trying to, just beginning, I think, really after 10, 20 years now of this accelerated age, to start to say, how do I love someone in a virtual space in the same way that I would want to love them as my neighbor? So what do our online relationships and neighborliness look like?
All right, friends, we've got to take a quick break. But when I come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Craig Detweiler about his book, iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back.
I want to know you. I want to find you in every season, in every moment.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined in conversation today by Craig Detweiler. We are talking about his book, iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. You can follow Craig on Twitter at Craig Detweiler. Craig, again, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Always great to chat with you, Carmen. You're doing great work here.
Oh, you're so kind. Okay, so one of my favorite observations that you make, or most interesting or enlightening observations that you have made, is that Jesus was a techie. Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, you know, as I did my research, I wanted to go back and think, you know, we think about God as creator, but maybe not as technologist. And when we think about Jesus, we say, well, you know, Jesus was the son of a carpenter, but we don't know maybe what he might think about technology. Does all this technology just surprise him? Well, if you do a word study on the Greek word for carpenter, it's actually tekton. So Jesus was the son of a tekton, and that word tekton is the same word where we get techne, where we get the word technology. And so I don't think Jesus is surprised. I think he's actually very comfortable. You know, in a sense, his father, that training was practical problem solving. It was engineering of a sort as a carpenter in the ancient world. And so I don't think Jesus is scared of a world of ones and O's, of digital formats. And so rather than seeing God and Jesus as somehow foreign or antithetical to this world, I think what I want to do is find my relationship with God within the this kind of accelerated age that we're in. And so how do I bring Jesus into my online activities, into my social media landscape, rather than trying to say, well, that's separate, right? Jesus doesn't have anything to do with that. As a tecton, the son of a tecton, I think Jesus is very well acquainted with and comfortable with entering into this space.
So the other thing that you talk about is the concept of having a theology of technology. What is your theology of technology, Professor Detweiler?
Well, I don't think it's as far fetched as we might think it is. We might say, well, gosh, the ancient world, there wasn't anything electronic in the ancient world. And yet, from the very beginning, we find that God, as creator, it says God was separating light from darkness, land from sea. And in a sense, that's all that when you do a search online, when you look for something via Google, that's all they're doing. They're looking through all the data online and saying, is this land or sea? Is this light or dark? They're going through ones and O's and choices. And so what it's doing is doing an accelerated search through the entire world of online in the same way that God helped us categorize our world and understand our world and make shape of our world. And so when we create a bridge to get from one place to another, we're using God's gift. We're putting our theology and our gifting into action. When we create medicine, that's a technology that is possible to save lives. And yet when we create bombs, we're creating a technology that can take lives, that can rob people of their lives and of their livelihood. So when I went back in Scripture, I went back to Genesis, and I thought about this, and I realized that, you know, in the story of Noah, you have God offering instructions to Noah to build an ark to preserve biodiversity on the planet, to save humanity, to save the animals. And so technology can be a life-saving gift. But what is the story right after Noah? The next story in the Bible involves a group that is gathered to build a tower. And it says that they're building a tower, a platform even, to elevate themselves. And so the Tower of Babel becomes a cautionary tale about technology that is used for self-glorification and to try to elevate ourselves to a loftier plane, to be like God. And so technology can also be a self-serving folly that has pitfalls within it. And both those stories are in the Bible as a way to say, how do you respond to God's call? Are you going to respond to God's gifts by being responsible, by being life-giving, or are you going to be self-elevating and self-promoting? And I think that tension and those questions reside behind every post and every activity that we engage in online. So that's, I think, at the heart of my theology of technology. I think the question is, who or what is being elevated via our online activities?
Well, and I think that's a nice segue to, you know, maybe from thinking about the tools to thinking about the social media and our engagement in social networks or what those relationships now look like, especially now, Craig, that we recognize that, in fact, every account that's online is not necessarily, is there even a real person behind it? And I may not be engaging with a human being when I'm engaging on social media. I may be engaging with a bot. I certainly may be engaging with someone who is not representing themselves as, you know, as who they really are. Talk with us about not just how we can protect ourselves and protect our kids, but protect the whole concept of social relationships. in terms of, you know, we have to know one another. We have to really know one another. We can't just move into a virtual reality of social networking. Just run around in that area for a minute.
Sure, sure. Yes, the need for discernment, I don't think has ever been greater. And so, you know, as an educator, as a seminary president here at the Seattle School, I want to create savvy Christians who can see through a ruse, who can see through a bot, and understand maybe the connection between our real life and our online life. At the core of this challenge of technology is this question of what does it mean to be human? And even as, you know, the machines, in a sense, the search engines get smarter, and artificial intelligence rises, the need to be physically present for each other, I think, is going to be greater and greater. And so you might be tempted to say, well, gosh, you know, I'm listening, you know, to Carmen's show, and I can listen to a sermon online, and, you know, do I need to be part of a local church? Do I need to be part of a local community? And I think the answer is yes. We need to be bodily, physically showing up for each other. There's a reason why, you know, Jesus, you know, in a sense, put on flesh and moved into the neighborhood. There's an incarnational aspect to our life that we really need to reclaim in an active way, to say that I'm more than just my brain. I am not just a bot, and we're not just it's not sufficient to just like something online. You know, social networks make it easy to sort of click on something and say, well, there, I've acknowledged them, or I've said that I will pray for them online. Well, maybe that's not enough. Maybe you need to actually get in the car and go over to someone's house and actually sit with them and pray with them and give them a hug and give them some chicken soup and really just offer our physical presence to each other. It could be that we, as people of faith, will be the last people who actually believe and care about the body and believe that in the same way that Jesus you know, dignified who we are as people by taking on physical form, that we also must be incarnational in our relationships with each other.
Well, that is the greatest answer I could have ever hoped to have heard, because I just absolutely, I resonate so, wow, I resonate with that, because I feel like when you're talking about the real need, the desperate need for undivided attention, for us to give one another the time of day, right? And that's the greatest gift that I have to give another person is my time. It's the one resource that's actually totally limited. And yet, you know, God gives it to us freely, and then God reinforces that by, you know, by sending Jesus. You know, when you do sort of feel like if he had wanted to, he could have not gone to all that trouble. And so,
yeah.
Right? Like, you know, virtual yeah. reality or AI might have been enough. But it.
Yes.
But God knew that, you know, like we needed Jesus with some flesh on. And the world still does. And, you know, and the resurrection of Christ is a bodily reality. And it matters. And you and I represent that risen reality. And that should really change not only our relationships with one another, but it should change the way we engage as kingdom ambassadors in the world.
Well said.
So that's my own little sermon there at the end of our conversation.
Well said. No, the implications of this are huge, and so we may need to be more countercultural, really, than we have been when it comes to this, or at least be more intentional to say that, gosh, if you know, if God asked us, you know, if God needed a Sabbath rest, maybe I need a Sabbath rest. If God said, you know, I need to cease from working and striving, and now we have these phones that keep us constantly on and constantly available, then maybe I do need to power down in order to power up, that I have to take a break and say, no, my body limits me. and I only have so much attention. So if I'm going to be fully present to God and to my family, then I'm going to need a Sabbath, and I'm going to need to be intentional. And so maybe the way forward in an accelerated age is to actually go back to those roots in Genesis of what does it mean to be human and how do we create a sustainable, healthy life. That's really what we teach at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. That's our hope, is to have this integrated faith that we can go on the full long-term discipleship journey with God.
I love that. All right, friends, Craig Detweiler is the voice you are hearing. He's the author of iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. He is also the president of the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. You can follow him on Twitter at Craig Detweiler. Craig, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Carmen, it's an honor to be part of this work of, just trying to get more education, information, and hopefully transformation available towards people. So thank you for being a significant part of the media. Grateful for your work.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that affirmation. All right, folks, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. So we're going to make the connecting point, and we're going to do so today with our friend Tim Muehlhoff. He is a college professor. He is also an author. His newest book, Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World, is an excellent resource for us. But what he and I are going to talk about today is actually an event he recently attended called Better Angels. Tim, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be back, Carmen.
All right. It's always great to talk with you. And when I read about this Better Angels event, I did think to myself, I bet I knew some people who were in the room. And now I know you were in the room. So why don't you just tell people like what the event was. And then we'll talk about, you know, sort of what the outflow of that event we hope will be for other people.
Sure. Better Angels was started by a man named David Blankenhorn. He's worked in Washington for a long time. He's a writer. And he's frustrated, just like everybody else, that we've lost the ability to talk to each other, particularly about politics. So he started this group called Better Angels. That's taken from an Abraham Lincoln speech, appealing to the better angels of our nature. And it specifically is training people how to have neighborhood conversations where Democrats and Republicans come together and talk about social issues, political issues. But these moderators are trained on how, you know, not to let it devolve into World War III, but how to talk with civility, perspective-taking, empathy. So my friend, my co-author, Rick Langer, we went to Virginia and were trained for 4 days with other people interested, Christians, non-Christians, Muslim activists were there. It was a fascinating group of people. But here's the cool thing, Carmen, that happened. I registered as an independent, but I was given a blue lanyard signifying Democrat. So when people came up to me, Republicans wearing red, they just immediately assumed they knew everything about me because I had on a blue lanyard. You know, so I'm pro-choice, I'm pro-gay marriage, I'm pro-everything. Just from the color of my lanyard, it was a fascinating exercise in how we often judge people based on these broad stereotypes.
Okay, so I have that exact same experience. Virtually any convention or event I go to, there's a huge dilemma about exactly what's going to be on that sort of placard that you're hanging around your neck.
Right.
It's actually a huge deal because it is the first way in which people judge us. So am I a radio host? Am I a communicator? Am I a person? Am I an author? And am I Mrs. LaBerge? Right. I mean, like,
right.
I'm not. And the truth is, yes, I'm all those things. But the assumptions that we make about one another are simply based on, in your case, the color of the name tag. Like, that's I think that's really illustrative of just how polarized we have become and how many assumptions that we make, how many prejudgments, how much prejudice we have in our conversations today.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote I stuck in Winsome Persuasion, you know, my newest book. The quote was, an Episcopalian said to a Baptist, I can't listen to you because of what I think you're about to say. And so it was really fun during this conference, Carmen, to be talking to a person who's read, and probably on social issues, we agree with each other, but he or she is assuming that I'm staunchly blue. So in a conversation where I'd actually say, oh, by the way, I'm pro-life. And they're like, what? You're what? I said, oh, yeah, I'm pro-life. And I just kind of played with it, you know, busting stereotypes, because they, again, first thing they would do, Carmen, is they would look at my lanyard, like, oh, okay, it is blue. You're pro-life? And it's, so it was so fun to break stereotypes. And I think that's a great lesson for all of the listeners. Look for ways to break stereotypes of the conservative Christian perspective. Look for areas of common ground that will kind of surprise people rather than fortifying opinions of us or stereotypes of us.
So I'm interested, the folks who gathered at this event, you guys probably spent some time sort of, you know, assessing who's in the room, why people are here, you know, how are you feeling about polarization? What were some of the stories you heard in terms of what the experience, let's say, of a red has been in a predominantly blue family, or a blue has been in a predominantly red workplace, or a college student has been on their college campus? Like, I'm sure you heard some stories. Can you relate what folks' experience has been in the last couple of years?
Oh, let me give you my favorite story from the whole 4 days. So what you do is you partner with a person. So a red and a blue partner together in their community to do these workshops, these conversations. Well, so people have been doing this for like a year, and one group got up. He is on staff with Focus on the Family, and she is a ardent lesbian activist.
So we're going to guess he's a red.
Up.
We're going to guess he's a red, and we're going to guess she's a blue.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, exactly. And you could have heard a pin drop, Carmen. And they both got up and said, listen, we believe radically different things, but we both love each other. We both believe in what Better Angels is trying to do, which is to foster good conversations rather than indoctrinate people. So even though, and she said, Focus on the Family has spent millions trying to keep me from being able to marry the woman I love. But this is a good man standing next to me. And he reciprocated and said, listen, she's my friend. We're not just partners in this. We're friends in this. And, yeah, we have big disagreements. But what brings us together is calling Americans back to civility. You could have heard a pin drop. And I just sat there. I wanted to get up on my table and whistle, take my shirt off, wave it over my head. Like, I think that's brilliant. He didn't cave on any of his beliefs. But there was a way that this person from Focus on the Family was able to foster this relationship for a higher good, and the higher good is for us to be peacemakers, and I think for us as Christians, that's huge motivation from the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the peacemakers, they should be called the children of God. So I love the fact that, man, if somebody from Focus on the Family can do that with a lesbian activist, then I think we can do it. Now, I can already hear some listeners saying, well, wait a minute, he compromised. Right, him just standing up there means he's condoning her perspective, and I would argue that's not true. They are focusing on a bigger cause, which is to foster good conversations, and he hasn't condoned her lifestyle, nor has she condoned his biblical beliefs. But something higher was at work, and that's peacemaking and having good, productive conversations, and I think as Christians we ought to look for those opportunities.
So friends, I'm talking today with Tim Muehlhoff. Tim, you just made me so happy that we're on radio and not television, because I will now live with the fear that you might just at any point stand up on a table and take off your shirt. Like, I had not been living with this kind of fear until just now. And so,
well, praise the Lord for radio.
Praise the Lord for radio. Amen. Okay. So here's an observation that I would like to make, because I can love the one. I can get to know the one. I can, I can befriend the one. But I can still hold in contempt the 100 million. So help me see sort of the next step. How does what you all experienced in the one-on-one translate to the problems we have with 100 million people lining up against 100 million people?
Yeah, that's a great point. And the short answer to that is, Carmen, I have no idea. Because my book is written, really, Winsome Persuasion is written on the communal level, the community level. I will grant you that the national discourse is just a mess, because the national discourse doesn't happen in town halls or Starbucks. It happens nationally through national media, and that just skews the whole conversation. So what I would say is, my job isn't to love, let's say, the Democratic Party. My job is to love the Democrats within my community, or vice versa, the Republicans, when I think they're going off the rails, truly as an independent. So I love groups rather than this national dialogue where everything's getting skewed and you're hearing the worst of each other. I would rather hope that we can be rooted in a community like, you know, the Church of Corinth, the Church at Ephesus, the Church at Rome. They were local communities that really did reach out to their neighbors, exhibiting neighbor love. So I think my job, Carmen, is in the people I rub shoulders with, I need to love them as individuals, and maybe that'll soften a little bit. Like if I get to know two people from a political party that kind of blow my stereotypes, then maybe I can extrapolate that there's more of these people, that maybe this political party isn't as staunch or off the rails as I assumed, because I found two people who are wonderful counterbalances to the stereotype. So I would say start local and allow this local neighbor love maybe to bleed out more towards the regional, national level.
So I think you're exactly right. I do think that this starts with individual conversations, and then those conversations are witnessed by others who become interested in having those kinds of conversations. And it also, I think, makes us listen differently to the media. I think mm-hmm. that once I know that they're not speaking truth about one person who I know, as long as I know there's an outlier, I'll at least furrow my brow and listen with greater discernment than I would if I didn't know anybody in the community that they're talking about. And so,
yeah,
or in the party that they're talking about. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry for cutting you off. So I did an exercise. Remember when President Trump met with Putin? Remember that meeting that took place? Well,
yes. You
watch CNN's handling of it, and they're calling it treasonous and want him impeached. And then you watch Fox News, and they were hailing it as a great step forward and much better than what President Obama did or anything like that. So I think I would say to your listeners, don't get locked into one news source. It was fascinating to listen to both CNN and Fox side by side, and who knows where exactly the truth is, but it gave me a much broader, more complex picture of how Americans view this and how news sources view this. So I would just say to your listeners, don't get locked into one podcast, one TV news program. I mean, let's be diverse, and then we'll have to use discernment as we form a composite picture of some really complex issues.
Absolutely. Hey, friends, if you want more information about what we're talking about, Better Angels actually has a website. That won't surprise you. There are some other efforts out there that I think that, if folks are not aware of, like, the No Labels effort in Washington that promotes compromise through this sort of problem-solving caucus in Congress. And again, compromise is not a dirty word when what we're talking mm-hmm. about is finding solutions that are for the common good. Like, there, you know, we're not talking about compromising ideals. We're talking about finding solutions that work together. And so, you know, I want to encourage people to actually explore what's going on, maybe in your own church, certainly in your own community, and how you can actually engage in the kinds of conversations that Tim and I are talking about. My guest has been Tim Muehlhoff. You can check out his book, Winsome Persuasion, and everything else that he's written. Well worthy of reading. Tim, thanks for joining us again today on Connecting Faith.
My pleasure, Carmen.
Hey, friends, that's all we got time for today here on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.